Hello and welcome back to Quiver, the Green Arrow podcast. This is our third episode of season three. For the episode Corto Maltese, I am one of your hosts, Michael Cohen.
And I'm your other host, Amanda Konkin. You know what I just realized? Every time I introduce myself, I put my hands up near my face, sort of jazz hands, as if you can see me.
It helps, though. It helps. You got to do the stuff.
It's my special host introduction.
I think the biggest difference between good podcasters and bad podcasters is that bad podcasters are aware that they're on a podcast. So they talk like they're on a podcast, right? But a good podcaster, I think the same thing goes for radio broadcasters, right? Like, I am not having a conversation just with you.
Yeah.
Like, we're having a conversation with whoever else is listening to
this.
All, however many of you there are at any given time in the past, present, and future. So, I think that's more important than being like, oh, we're going to sit here and talk like we're on NPR. Right? And it's like, we're not. We're going to have a conversation. And, you know, we'll just talk like we're talking to each other. And we are in the same room. So I think that
helps. Can I just give shout out to whoever's listening to this for the first time in 2016 to totally send a tweet to @AConkin because this message is directly for you.
You're going
to
get a lot of tweets in 2016.
It'll be great. I just got a tweet today, actually, from someone that just started listening to the podcast. Yeah. And it was like,
That's a good place to jump in on this email here.
Nice.
We've got an email from Ian, and he says, subject line, quiver overload.
Ooh, yes, that's the best.
Forgive me if there are gaps in my... this isn't the email, this is me talking. Like, forgive me if there are gaps in what I say, like if I have to take like small pauses. I ate ice cream cake, which was a bad idea, and I knew it was a bad idea, but I did it anyways because I am technically lactose intolerant, but if I take some pills, I'll be okay. That doesn't mean that it won't make me burp a lot, and I'm going to not burp on mic, but if there are like points where I'm talking and then I just go like, it's because I'm trying not to be rude. So just know in advance that that's going to happen during this episode. I'm going to try and keep it to a minimum. There's email from Ian. Subject line, quiver overload. Hey, Mike, Amanda, and all arrowheads.
Yeah.
That's great. See,
yeah,
like, Ian
totally,
gets it.
Yeah,
Ian gets
totally.
It. It's all of us. The podcast, not just the two of us. Love Arrow and found your podcast only a few weeks ago. I don't know why that's in quote marks, but it is. I've spent the last few weeks listening to every show to catch up.
Wow, that's
now,
impressive.
Now suffering extreme quiver overload, but with a feel for your format. Fun podcast, guys. So we're glad that when people binge watch, like, because that's our society now, right?
Yeah,
it's like we want all of it, and we want it all right now.
Yeah.
I want to watch all of Orange is the New Black immediately the second that it's available.
Yeah.
I do not want to wait week to week.
Yeah.
I'm in the UK, so even watching at US pace, I'm a bit behind, but loved the first episode. I'm with you, Mike. So sad to see Sarah killed off. Oh, it's good. We'll just keep bringing it up. Great character, and I'll miss this canary. At least the producers have said Katie will still be seen in flashbacks, so she's not gone forever. But boo to killing her off. Not good. Oh, last thought. If episode one was The Calm, how long until we get an episode called The Storm? Keep up the good work and stay sharp, arrowheads. That's from Ian. So thank you, Ian. So what do you think? How long until The Storm?
It's either the mid-season finale or the finale.
Yeah.
I think it's the mid-season finale.
Yeah, I'm with you. Yeah. I think it's the mid-season finale.
Yeah.
Yeah. We know that we've got episodes, 7 and 8 are the crossover, I think.
I'm so excited!
With Flash. And then I think that there will be one episode after that, and then we'll get the break. I think that's the way that things are going. I think that episode is when we're going to find out who killed Sarah. It's when Malcolm is going to reveal himself to Oliver, and all of that craziness is going to start. I think it's when Laurel will put on the mask for the first time.
Yeah, yeah. This is about the time, right? Because there was some photos that surfaced of...
They would be filming episode 9 right around now.
Yeah.
Right, so...
Which is awesome.
I think that's where we're at. I think that that's how things are going to play out. Now, having said that, track record shows that we make a bunch of predictions.
Yeah.
And I think we're about like 50-50, which I think is good. I think that's good for all of the wild accusations that we make.
Yeah.
But
we do make a lot of really wild
accusations. More often than not, we are right about what's going to happen. We are very wrong about the timing.
Yeah,
and it usually happens the way, you know what? Malcolm's going to show up like around mid-season finale. And then next week
he'll show up.
And we didn't get to see the next time on, so who knows? Maybe Malcolm does show up next week.
No idea.
And you guys already all know that.
Yeah.
But for some reason they played the original's preview.
No, Vampire Diaries.
Sorry, Vampire Diaries preview. Sorry, they look like the same thing to me.
They are a spinoff.
They played a Vampire Diaries preview over top of the preview for next week's Arrow.
Yeah, it was very weird.
So all we got was Arrow logo and then tune in next week on Arrow and Oliver standing with a bow and arrow.
Yeah,
at the
like
end
we
of
didn't
it,
actually get to
see everything.
Yeah. So it was kind of sad. But
so who knows? Maybe you guys already all know that Malcolm is gonna
interesting. And I mean they do throw curves at us, so who knows in the storm. Maybe it'll be more subtle and they just will put the storm through everything. I have a confession to make this week, Mike, because I feel kind of like a jerk for being such an Elicity hater. Because if the feels that people had for Elicity are the feels I had for Smoker right now, I feel like I just slapped them all across the face. Because I have so many feels about Ray and Felicity that it's just not even funny. I love them together, and it's mostly because I just love Felicity, and I love when somebody who's powerful makes her more powerful. And that's, right, like this idea, or allows her to be more powerful is what I meant. That because Felicity is powerful, and Ray recognizes that and admires it and loves it. And that is something that I really think is just so great for her.
I like the dynamic that they're setting up.
Yeah.
Because when Oliver finds out, because Felicity is keeping a lot of this a secret, when Oliver finds out what's going on, he's gonna be pissed. Because, not because like, oh, Felicity is my property, but because he's gonna turn around and realize, oh crap, I took Felicity for granted.
Yeah.
I made a bunch of mistakes, and now here's this guy who stole my company out from under me, and now he's stealing Felicity, but he's doing it, like, he's being the Oliver Queen that I want to be, but I'm too busy being the Arrow to do that.
And that's the thing, is that Ray Palmer will never be the superhero that Oliver Queen is, because Oliver cannot be
it's a
sacrifice, and that's part of the beauty of his character. And what I really love that they acknowledged last week was that Ollie needs to be who he is in order to function as both Oliver Queen and Arrow.
He can't be fighting himself,
and I really love that about him, and I think it's what makes him unique, and it's what makes him the superhero that he is. So I appreciate that. I do stick to my guns, as much as it is slapping Elicity fans across the face. I do genuinely believe that right now, in the stage of what hero he is, she is not the right fit for him to be still her own person.
It's not, you know, it's not that we don't want Felicity and Oliver to be together.
Yeah, no.
It's that I, personally, and I think that you're on the same page, I don't feel like that's the interesting story to tell right now. I think that both of those characters have stories to tell at the moment, and neither one of them involve a romantic interest.
And I think that I would love it if the show actually did go into a genuine direction. I think I've said this before, where they do end up together. I just don't think it's the strongest story they can tell.
Lois and Clark ending up together around season 8 of Smallville, and then Lois knowing everything by season 9 at the latest. I have to go back and watch stuff in order to
I know exactly what it is. She found out in the season finale of season 9
because she
kissed him and then found out that he was the blur.
When you get to season 10, and everything is like a hair's breadth away from just being Superman.
Yeah.
And Lois and Clark are in this great relationship where they understand each other, they support each other, they feed each other off of their energies and stuff like that. Like, there's just such a great balance there. And it is totally earned because of all of the trials that they've been through separately and together.
Yeah.
And so when those characters come together by the end of that series, especially in that final episode, in that final 5 minutes.
Oh.
Right? Like, it just...
It's just so good.
It means so much more to the audience.
Yeah.
And it's, that's a Destiny thing, so, I don't feel like any of that is spoilers or giving anything away.
Yeah, no, it's Destiny. That,
Lois and Clark are Lois and Clark, right? Yeah. You can't say, I mean, the fact that Lois gets top billing...
Well, can I just say, I just noticed that, actually, as we said it, it's something that's, I think, super important.
Not Clark and Lois,
because Clark Kent is Superman, and she will never... take that away from him.
But she's so much stronger than him because she can't deflect bullets.
And
right?
she is Lois. She gets to be Lois, and he lets her be Lois because he doesn't need to be anything. Anyways, it's just
The important part there between in that relationship is exactly what you're saying, is that Lois is constantly getting herself into situations where she is in trouble. And this comes out of the history of the character being a damsel in distress, but having evolved over the years and the character that Lois is now, she gets herself into situations and then she can get herself out, especially Erica Durance's Lois.
Yeah.
Like that character was so strong on her own that she is the only woman that Superman can be with because he's Superman.
Yeah.
But who matches and then beats him? Lois Lane, right? Yeah. Like, she's a stronger character than he is. And Felicity, I think, has the makings of that, but she still has a lot of insecurities. She still is very unsure of her place in the world. This episode showed that off a lot, but it also showed the potential that she has.
Yeah.
And so when that potential is realized later on in the series, which it will be, I mean, we know that this is going somewhere because everything in the show is always going somewhere. And when that potential is realized, I think at that point she'll be in a position to be that character for somebody.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that it's necessarily going to end up being Oliver, because I think they did the same thing with Chloe. I think that Chloe started in a very similar position.
She did,
and became the character that she became. And ends up with Green Arrow, right?
Yeah.
It's a very similar, very similar situation.
And
I don't know, maybe that's what they're going to do here. At the same time, there's a predestined outcome here with Laurel and Oliver.
And
but we'll see if that ends up being...
Can I also just say that Laurel is doing... This was a great Laurel episode where I went, huh, I like her journey right now.
Four characters that were not Oliver had fantastic stories in this episode.
It's just, it's great.
And it shows the strength of this series and what Flash has to live up to.
Yeah.
And honestly, I'm not going to say too much because you haven't seen it yet, but this week's episode of Flash is a step in the right direction because they start developing Caitlin's character a little bit more.
Nice.
And I think that there's a lot there for that character.
Cool.
And Robbie Amell showed up for the first time as well.
Woo!
Which is cool.
But this
episode developed so many characters in so many great directions. Awesome. And none of them were superheroes.
Yeah.
Like, that's kinda the cool thing is that you know what? Oliver's a superhero now.
Yeah.
So is his story the most important? Clearly not, because the flashbacks this episode were all about Thea.
Yeah.
And the flashbacks in a couple episodes are all about Felicity. Like, he is surrounded by characters that are just as strong as he is.
Yeah.
But that also have journeys that they're on.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, like, when are we going to get a Roy flashback, right?
Yeah.
When do we get another Diggle flashback, right? Because these are things that are going to come.
Yeah.
All of these characters deserve their own stories.
Yeah.
It's not just Oliver and how he became the Arrow, because I think we kind of get the gist of it now.
Which is awesome. Can I just... I do... want this all like on record as much as possible. The more I keep contemplating it, the more I'm just like, obviously, he's gonna die in 2 years. Like, it just makes the most sense for the fifth season for him to die and then it jump ahead 5 years. It just makes the most story narrative sense. It would be awesome. Because people are talking to him, like, other people were tweeting or on Facebook about his son, because that's something that, again, just got completely slipped under the rug. That, what's his name? Connor?
Connor, yeah.
Oh, Connor's the name of every brooding hero's long-lost child. Okay, maybe just Angel. But, like, still, these sons that come back into their life when they're grown-ups. I don't know. I just think it'd be interesting. But that just sort of... I'm starting to rethink, you know what's really awesome? Reliving Arrow through other people. Because I have a couple friends, actually, right now that are watching Arrow for the first time. And it's so fascinating to just hear how they're reacting to things and what sort of things they're interested in or their predictions, which are really awesome. So I had my friend texted me today and sort of was like, Slade's bad now? What? And it was just one of these things that was just like really great. Yeah.
Even better if they have no comics knowledge.
Yeah, which is totally great. And it was just, Slade's the bad guy now? Question mark, question mark. No. It's just really funny.
Awesome. Cool. Yeah. Well, let's jump into this episode, Cordo Maltese. But before we do that, we have an email from Tim Underwood, and he just writes to let us know that Corto Maltese is actually a fictional country in the DCU off the coast of South America, which is what we saw in the show, right? So that's actually, they're pulling that from the comics.
Nice.
And Curtis, my co-host on the Pullbox podcast, wanted us to let you guys know that Corto Maltese is actually a reference to a comic book, to a series. So I don't know, maybe what I'll say, rather than us getting into it, I am recording with Curtis this Saturday. So tune into the next episode of the Pullbox podcast and I'll have Curtis explain where that name comes from and the legacy of it. So
there's that little spin-off episode intrigue for us. Yay.
So now you have to listen to the Pullbox podcast at pullboxpodcast.com.
Yeah, excellent.
Good. Okay, cool. With that, let's jump into Corto Maltese, which I'm already sick of saying. Okay. Oh, I do not have this queued up.
I sort of thought...
Vamp!
I sort of thought, but we get to watch the big explosion. You did. It was almost.
It was almost.
It's here. The new intro, which I kind of like.
Yes.
Oh man.
Slightly different wording.
Did you see someone totally get owned by Stephen Amell on their Facebook page, where she sort of said that?
Oh yeah, like she said, like I'm
so
done with
sick
this show.
Of the I am Oliver Queen, and it's so. But I'm like, actually, no, they changed it this year. I really enjoy it. Like, I think it's really cool.
They tend to change it. A couple times every season.
Yeah,
right?
And they make it work just well enough.
And they're doing
great.
The same thing on Flash. Oh my god! How many times are you gonna show me
Sarah
dying?
And
they
showed
the dumpster part that
her
time.
Falling. Yep, her hitting that freaking dumpster. How
I can't handle it.
Yeah, it's a little bit intense.
It's so mean.
You know
I feel like Roy felt in that scene that they just showed.
I'm missing Roy this year. I want a bit more Roy.
He had some good stuff
this episode.
My favorite thing about Roy is that even though he hasn't had that much dialogue this season, he's had a lot of screen time. He's been on screen quite a bit.
Yeah.
But his character has developed so much in the 3 months that we were going.
Yeah, it's great. It's great. And so we've got this flashback to 6 months ago with Merlin and Thea in this conveniently blacked out limousine. So that I bet you they filmed this like inside a studio of some kind.
They're probably just parked at Beresford, right? Like,
well, because they would have, because that outside shot, they could have just taken her to go do that. And then just like when they have John Barrowman
around.
It's
just a 10-minute drive from the studio.
Yeah, which is great. But so we sort of get where she's going. I thought the
Do you notice that, like, you pointed this out when we were watching it the first time. You pointed out that John Barrowman has a very prominent cleft.
Yeah.
I've never noticed it before.
Yeah.
But Thea also has a cleft in her chin. It's more subtle.
Slightly.
But That's genetic, right? It has to come from a parent.
Interesting.
Right? Like, a person doesn't just randomly have a cleft chin.
Interesting.
That's a genetic trait.
That is a very specific... Then, yes, they set that up to be specifically
I'm going to wait and see, does Oliver have a cleft chin?
Interesting.
Right? Where did it come from? Did it come specifically from John Barrowman's butt chin, as you call it?
That is implied by that.
I'm trying to think if he does, and I cannot picture his chin specifically.
I don't think he does. I'm surprised that Stephen Amell's face is not ingrained into my brain yet.
I think he has a very strong. He might have a small dimple.
Beard all the time. Yeah.
Yeah, that's true.
Maybe a dimple chin. This lassoed him with a.
I know
arrow.
He has a very strong chin.
Yes.
He's got a good chin.
Yeah.
Not like me. I don't have a chin. That's why I have a beard.
Yeah.
No, it's not cleft.
I don't think it's
cleft.
No.
So there's your. That's the first clue that they're not as related.
And that was really good. Whoever set that scene up then did a really good job. Because
I think it's accidental.
It's weird.
But
you never know.
It's a coincidence.
You never know. Back at the.
Oliver's trying to track down whoever killed Sarah.
Yeah.
I think that little bit was just to show that
he
hasn't given up.
This
is still important. He picked up that little glass shard last week.
Yeah.
And now this week they pulled fingerprints off of it.
Yeah, he's still figuring out what's going on. This is the only time he wears this his suit though too. Is just his opening bit, right? The rest of it is sort of
In the whole episode. Yeah, you're right.
I love that they just go over top of Tech Village. I didn't realize that she was actually lying to them about where she's working without actually lying.
Omission.
But she's lying by omission, right?
Yeah.
Which is interesting.
I'm curious what her motivation is, other than just, not wanting everything that she does to be part of this.
Yeah.
Right?
Which is probably what it is. Which is interesting. I think so that it can be a thing in the episode entitled Felicity something or whatever. And it'll be, I don't know, I'm really...
It's going to come to a head in her flashback episode, I'm sure.
I'm really excited for that. Gosh, she's such an interesting character.
This
is the greatest part. Where Roy picks up his bow to get ready to go. And
I love how... one of my favorite things about this show, and I'm really hoping that The Flash does it as well, is how subversive it is of the CW superhero genre, genre TV tropes, where it's like, this is normally the moment where they would have had some conflict, contrived.
Where Ollie would have been like, "Where are you going? I gotta do this by myself."
Yeah, I'm bringing back Theo on my own.
Yeah,
but instead, it's like, what do you think you're doing? And it's like, I'm coming with you. It's like, no, you can come with me, but you can't bring your bow on an airplane. And then he just smiles back at Diggle, and it's just. These are the things that make this show a cut above so many other TV series.
Yeah.
Because Gotham, I'm 3-4 episodes into that. Maybe 3 episodes. I don't know. I think The Balloon Man's the last one that I watched, which was the 3rd episode. It's highly predictable, and it's just kind of blah. It's not even that it's... No, that's not true. It is that bad. The writing is terrible. It's like it's like a high school screenwriting class. Uh-huh. But... it's also just, it's dull.
Yeah.
It's just, they're not doing anything.
It doesn't
anything
seem exciting. I'm not excited to watch it.
Yeah.
Talking over Lila and Diggle here, who are kind of boring. I don't know. Sorry. But I don't know.
They are a little bit. But I think intentionally, right?
Because it's going to cause a thing. Obviously, with this episode and the Arya stuff.
I think there might be more going on here than we know of at the moment,
though.
And
I
think
Lila's using Diggle.
I think so, too.
There's some terrible manipulation here.
Yeah.
I would not be surprised if she got, forced to bring Diggle into the fold by having his kid. If that was an Amanda Waller objective.
She does, as she says at the end of the episode, she does whatever Amanda Waller tells
and
her.
And I feel like it's... That's
and
now
this
my
episode,
prediction.
The A story of this episode is all pointing at Amanda Waller being a bad guy.
Exactly.
This guy is going to great lengths and sacrificing friends
yeah.
in order to get out from under her thumb.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And we know because of the flashbacks that Amanda Waller is not a good person. Yeah. She's threatening to kill Oliver's family and kill these other people.
So let's just admire this shirtless man for a little moment that just showed up on
Wildcat.
Screen.
Ted Grant.
Ted Grant. So I didn't pick up the name because she says it right away. She says Ted Grant. But there's just a difference between a day player and a player that's going to be on for a really long time. Because I sort of thought that this was just some guy at the gym that she was infiltrating or questioning. But then he really holds his own and this is a really interesting scene. So that's
it's
cool.
This right here. It's that moment right there, that little thing that he does with his head
and
that you know,
yeah.
Like, oh, he's not just a like you say, a day player.
Yeah,
right? Like,
he's going to be
he's a recurring character.
Yeah, and because, he's got some depth to his character.
Yeah,
and,
he's done a little bit of work on it, right?
Yeah.
He's coming into it with,
yeah,
in this specific instance, some swagger.
Yeah,
that's,
and
that's
this, oh,
what,
that totally is.
Got.
And this idea that he just gets to read Laurel, like, right off the bat, is just very, very interesting. So
character that is going to be very important in the Black Canary's future.
Yeah,
I think.
It's as we see. What's that suit is striped in a weird way. Sorry.
Yeah, they had a weird texture.
Look at this B cam footage of some actual tropical town. They just
some South American something.
But look at the greens going to town on this place. Vancouver does not have palm trees. Oh man, greens is a great field if you can get into greens, because you just get to do landscaping for way more than just a lot of money. But the lighting in this is really interesting too, because they have
career tips from Amanda.
I don't know, if you can get into greens, it's great because you just, you know, put up the plants. It's good. I mean, it's hard work. You're outside and sun and rain, but and this house is great. It's got such a weird yellow tinge because they're trying to make it. So you're not supposed to know who that is that's shooting the bow, hey?
Yeah.
The inside, you're supposed to know if it's like Theo or... Oh, this is actually Spanish. Mia's brother. So, oh, Mia is the first time that we've actually heard her be called Mia, who...
Which we didn't get an explanation for.
No.
We just...
They're just, you know... implying. Sorry, we were caught in Merlin.
So, so Mia is the name Mia Dearden, one of Oliver's many sidekicks.
Mm-hmm.
We know that Thea, her middle name is Dearden.
She's
Thea Dearden Queen.
Mm-hmm.
And so now she here probably going by Mia Dearden in Corto Maltese.
Makes sense.
As her assumed name, her assumed identity. And we're getting, this is another flashback to you know, her Jedi training regimen here with, actually, I guess Sith training.
Yeah.
Because he's going to teach her how to be a hardcore ninja warrior.
Ninja warrior.
Like he is. And you know what? I think if it were any other middle-aged guy other than John Barrowman, I'd have a hard time believing some of the stuff that happens in this scene. But because it is John Barrowman, whatever he's selling, I'm buying.
Yeah.
So, like, oh, you're going to pour some hot wax over your hand? Cool.
Yeah. I want to know how they actually shot that scene, though.
What they used? Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's some sort of, like, latex or something like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's very cool.
Yeah, because it had that cool bubbling in it.
Yeah. Anyways, it's very fascinating. Wax, though, is one of the coolest things ever, sticking your hand in wax. Oh, it's so fun. Sorry, I play with candles a lot. Anyways, the cool...
That's dangerous, Amanda.
Yeah, sorry.
It's dangerous. Irresponsible.
Sorry. I know.
Don't play with fire. Oh, commercial break. I did this when we were watching the episode as well.
And
didn't notice
stuff.
That it went to a commercial. So we're just fast-forwarding right now.
Ingrained in the story.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's an interesting episode for Thea. She's grown a lot over the last 3 years, which is good.
Do you remember how obnoxious she was in season one?
Yup, I sure do.
Especially the first half of season one.
Yeah, it was very upsetting.
And now she's such a fantastic character.
She is. She's really great. I really love her new hair, too.
Yeah, especially that short hair.
It just works really well.
We're back. It's very superficial, but I think it works so much better.
It just makes her more grown up, is what it is, right? So she's more grown up, and
she looks more dynamic, right? Like it says a lot about her character, and where she's at than before. When I think I felt she was a little bit generic, she was a little bit dull, right? As much as they were trying to spice up her character last season with, you know, running the running Verdant and everything. Yeah. But
which is good. But this is now a good, interesting storyline for her. Yeah. I'm really excited to see where it goes.
I also think Willa Holland has come a long way.
Yeah.
Definitely. I mean, like, I'm a big fan of the OC. And have been watching her since then. So, as an actor, she's much stronger this season than I think she has been in a while. Like, there's more going on with the subtext.
Yeah.
Just the looks that she's giving Oliver right now.
Yeah. They're doing a lot of reaction shots in this too, and they're having this conversation. They have a conversation later where he tells a secret, right? This is just the first. Yeah. Right? So trying to convince her to come back. Thea took this very well. This was really interesting. I didn't realize
these characters react so maturely realistically.
You're like, oh wait, this isn't a problem at all. They're just gonna have a conversation about her coming home. That's great. And then the story doesn't
The fact that she doesn't go, how dare you follow me here? You tracked me down.
Yeah.
What? I told you I wanted space. Why can't you respect that? She's like, it's good to see you.
Yeah.
And I think she's genuine when she says that.
And it's great. I think, I don't know, it really does make a difference in this show. I think it's a really important element to it and really makes it watchable, right? Yeah. It makes it watchable because I'm not ever surprised by what the characters do in that was boring.
It's never one of those like, oh my god, are you serious, you're gonna do that, like, why would you put us through this obnoxious scene? Instead it's always interesting. This scene.
Can I just say, okay, I got people wrong last week with calling out Vancouver actors, but actually legitimately the executive assistant in this is DK, David K, who's been acting for a really long time. He was at the BFA at UBC. And, like, really interesting random fact that nobody cares about. Brad Pitt threw him his 5th birthday party because he was working on sets when he was little. I think that's, like, a really cool story for someone to have, that he just, like, grew up as an actor. Anyways, but I love this scene between Ray and Felicity. I already watched it before I watched the episode because it was...
Oh, okay. It was
Brandon Roth was on some terrible morning show. Anyways, and so I just, like, fast-forwarded through the morning show and just saw this part. Oh, his name is Jerry. Oh, he actually was credited as Jerry. Anyways, sorry. So, good job, David. But we find out here that Felicity has her own executive assistant, which is cool.
And which means that she's an executive.
Yeah, which is super cool. And then that he's treating her like a real person, and this is just super awesome that she gets a lot of really important roles and he understands how important she is. I think that's really cool.
So, what we're seeing here is what Oliver should have done last season for Felicity.
Yeah.
But instead, there he was a...
Made her the...
He did what he thought was best, but he didn't really...
Realize that... So she gets all these old office, which I just think is super cool that she's now there. I want to know what fake city they used for this, or what real city they used for this fake city.
Well, we're still trying to figure out what what real city they use for Starling City. Right?
Yeah, that's true.
So, we still don't know.
If people know what those are, let us know. Anyways, we've got the secondary plot where Diggle is after this weird rogue Argus dude. Wow, Diggle, those sunglasses were great. You should wear those more often. I always forget how good looking everybody on the show is.
How can you forget?
It becomes part of who they are. You can't, like, stare at them all day and nothing would sink in, but it's great. And I love that he calls himself Lila's baby daddy, because it's totally true. Anyways, a crazy guy brought out his knife and sort of was like, this is crazy. No, wait, what'd he say?
So my one problem with this story is that this guy has the buyer all set up for this, for the what's he called?
Thing, transcoder or whatever.
But he needs that little stick that Diggle has.
Yeah, so how is he going to get that otherwise?
How did he know that,
I'm going to watch that later here. I don't know. I think maybe it is explained later that he actually had something else. I don't know.
Oh my goodness. Are they shooting across from the church?
I'm pretty sure they're downtown.
They are downtown. Yeah. I know exactly where they are, and it does not look anything like that day to day.
They've just added all these palm trees. It's hilarious.
Right kitty corner from where they are standing is the building that they used as the, like, the sort of the stand-in building that they did the digital extension on for the watchtower, not the watchtower, but the clock tower.
Oh, cool.
That they blew up last season.
Yeah. Cool.
It's right there, which is actually an abandoned building right
now. Nice. But. And Harry and Laurel back at AA, which I love that they're still bringing this forward, and it's a continuing storyline that she is.
They didn't just drop it because it's not part of her story this season.
Because it totally is, because she's a real person and has real problems. I really like the interesting parallel that they do with, you know, alcohol addiction. When you're an addict, you're sort of an addict in multiple, right? This, it's sort of a trait, which I think is really interesting because they can bring that into the canary aspect of it and this desire or ability to throw herself entirely into this new thing that she's going to do, which is going to be, you know, so dangerous, right? Right. So like everything else, so.
And so she was just sharing about her rage and her anger and how she can't get rid of it. Mm-hmm. But now this woman is sharing, like, she's like basically a domestic abuse situation. And Laurel is sitting there just wishing that there was something that she could do about it.
Yeah.
And she expresses later on in the episode that there's like all this injustice mm-hmm. going on and she can't
just
really
wants to do something about it, yeah.
And I love that they're using this story as a foundation for this character, as the foundation for Black Canary, because I feel like this is in keeping with the core of that character.
Right.
Dinah Lance is very much like a sort of a crusader for these sorts of causes.
Mm.
She's what would be referred to as a street-level hero, as opposed to, like, Superman, who is a cosmic level, right? Or Batman, who's much more on, like, the anti-terrorist level, right?
Yeah.
Like Black Canary is street-level. Really so is Green Arrow, for that matter. He's a street-level hero as well.
Yeah.
So that means that they're going to deal with real world problems more than they're going to deal with the Joker threatening to blow up the football stadium,
which is so cool.
Darkseid blowing up the moon or something, right? Like,
yeah,
they're going to deal with drug dealers and domestic abuse, and
which is important.
Yeah, like much more relatable, much more grounded.
Yeah,
and I think what we're seeing already is a distinction in these things, between Flash and Arrow.
Right.
Flash is going to deal with with metahumans. But Arrow is going to deal with this.
Politics
and this military intrigue stuff that we're seeing here with Diggle. That's where those characters are at home, right?
Yeah. And so helping decode the actual. I guess he was going to hand over the actual without it being decoded. And now he can decode it?
Maybe
he was just going to give them the information, but now the information is even more valuable or something. I don't really know.
Well, maybe he knew that by going off
grid,
somebody would be sent.
Yeah, fair enough. That could be interesting.
Let's fast forward through this AT&T commercial.
I
really enjoy these AT&T commercials, by the way. We don't have AT&T up here, so they can't sell us anything. So we just get to watch the commercials
and
think if they're funny or not.
Yeah.
But that girl, she's like sort of a recurring character in them.
Mm.
She's got some good comedic timing.
Interesting. I have a question. In Superman, was the waitress that Superman was dating for a while named Chrissy? Because that totally is the same actress. That's like...
I don't know.
Yes.
Superman was dating a... What?
The waitress out in the... When he was up in Canada and was working at a diner of some kind. Anyways, just the actress...
Oh, in Man of Steel.
In Man of Steel, yeah. Anyways, the actress that plays the girl that just got beat up, like, by her boyfriend, was in Man of Steel as the waitress.
I don't think that we ever heard her name in Man
of Steel. I don't think we did, but it says waitress, so I assume since she has a name that was who it was. So it's kind of an interesting superhero link.
So we're back into the episode. And this is our scene where Roy is going to come talk to Thea.
Sort of with a little swagger there. Did you see that little swagger? Oh, yeah. I love him. He's so cute. Oh, we don't get enough Roy time.
I'm sure he's going to get his opportunity.
He will. I love that was just grunting.
Look, we focused a lot on Roy last season.
We did. It's
right?
true.
With
it's
the Mira
true.
Guru story.
Yeah, I think that's true.
His whole thing with Thea, and you know what, I'm getting a little bit ahead of ourselves, but now that Thea is coming back to Star City, I think that we're going
to
get
a
lot more of the two of them.
Yeah, I would be totally okay with that. Yeah. I liked it. It's good. They're good together. I like them. Just, you know, their dynamic is interesting.
Yeah.
I don't know. He's got such a great face.
Yes, he's very handsome. I love, again, sound like broken records, but I love his reaction here where she's just like, you know what? I'm happy here. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows who I am. I don't mm-hmm. have to be Thea Queen. I don't have to be Thea Merlin. I mm-hmm. can just be me.
Yeah.
And he goes, okay.
Yeah.
Like, right. if you're happy, then that's the only thing that's important to me, because I care about you, and I'm going to go now. And she's just like, wait, what?
That's a nice thing.
I think, like, her reaction towards the end of last season, when she started finding out all of these truths about characters that have been holding back information from her, she felt betrayed, obviously, and rightfully so, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And what she's discovering now is, oh, these people were... what they thought they were doing was the right thing. They were trying to protect me, or they were scared, or they had their own reasons. So now that she's developed as a character, when they come back into her life, she's much more likely to be like, oh, wait, maybe I had it wrong. You do care about me, right?
So this is an interesting... they used Merlin as a transition. He walked into the end of that scene, and then you go right into him beating Thea up, right, as this training moment. So there's this really interesting thing that you have to reread that moment. I watched it now the second time going, was that a genuine, I want her to be now a real person father moment, or I want her to now put her training into effect moment?
Yeah.
It's sort of this interesting thing where, because then later on in the episode, we know that he lets her win, right, and go back to Starling City.
Yeah.
And so what is the motivation behind that? And is Merlin a real person, or is he just 100% this Dark Archer training?
Yeah, is
person,
he using
right?
Thea?
Yeah. So what? To what extent?
Think,
he's using her, but to what extent?
I think Thea is absolutely a pawn in his game.
Yeah.
And I think that's the only way that we get Thea by the end of this season, hopefully.
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah.
Becoming her own character, right? Not being tied to these other characters.
Oh, and so we had Felicity looking up the streak lives. So this idea that the Flash. So because she's going on to the Flash next week, right?
Next Tuesday, she'll be
so
on the Flash.
Awesome. So that we have this tie-in, which is interesting. But so she's now getting these three different things coming at her. So we've got Roy Palmer trying to get her to help with the files that got damaged last year in the explosion.
Yeah.
And then Diggle has now called to ask about the looking up the bad guy and trying to figure stuff out. And I just love how Roy watches her in this scene. I think it's really, really interesting. Oh, and that's a great moment where he says, I hear that you've got a lot of stories, all of which are long.
Yeah.
Kind of, it's funny. Anyways, and then are we favor friends now when Laurel calls? And Laurel just doesn't get it because she doesn't get banter.
Or just friends.
Yeah. It's good.
I need you to Google a phone number for me.
Oh,
the Google
so
is phone.
So good. Anyways, I really loved it. Roy just is sort of watching her and observing her. It's just, his faces are so great. I also just love Brendan Roth. So just watching him is fantastic. Anyways.
Sorry, I'm just looking up.
So good. Pinging his GPS. And then she sort of goes, and realizes that Roy is judging her. Right. And, I don't know, that's like an interesting exchange where she's being really real with him. And he's seen a side of her that Ollie doesn't get to see, which I think is really interesting, right? And Roy gets it. Roy sees who she is and what and how she's thriving and reacting. I kind of love this too, this trio, the way that they film this. They're just walking Ollie's got his little backup, his Diggle and his Roy, as he walks through it. It's just, it's very interesting. It's a good shot.
I like that none of them can ever, like, go anywhere alone. that they're always kind of...
Diggle tried to stay home.
He did. He
tried to not do anything. Oh, poor Diggle. You have to...
I feel so bad for Diggle because I do think that there is...
So
like,
much more to
it.
Yeah.
This... The kid thing, it cannot last. It can't
it
last
can't,
on a
no.
show
and
like
it's,
this.
I genuinely
so he's
think,
just set up for a devastating
it's going to be so devastating. And I think like it was super the fact that Lila said, can you go to Cordon Maltese and deal with this thing, like that is not a that No, there's some. There's so much more there, and it's really interesting.
So here is Laurel
with a bat.
With a bat, and I enjoy that the tables get turned here, because what we're establishing is that these heroes are not just superheroes.
Mm-hmm.
Everything that they have is earned.
Yeah.
And Laurel doesn't get that yet. She doesn't understand. I think she understands now that she's gotten the crap kicked out of her.
Yeah.
That you have to earn that. We'll just fast forward through these commercials.
Yeah.
But
that you can't just wake up one day and be a hero, but you have to work for it and all the things that come with that.
It's along the same lines as what Malcolm says to Thea, which is that steel has to be tempered.
Right?
It's not just strong by nature. It has to be broken down and rebuilt that way.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we're seeing with... we're back, and now
Detective Lance.
I keep wanting to say Thea, and I don't mean Thea, I mean Laurel.
Yeah.
Is in the hospital, because she is very beaten up.
Do you think now, this is obviously a set that they've built, hey, this hospital set?
Yeah.
Oh, they're becoming Smallville. They have a hospital set. Anyway.
This conversation with Detective Lance and Laurel is so important in mm-hmm. the genesis of this character.
Yeah.
Of the Black Canary, of this new Black Canary persona.
Mm-hmm.
Because she, as she said, she just... There's these people out there, and they just get away with these injustices.
Yeah.
They deserve to be punished, but nobody else can do it.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm not changing my stance entirely.
Yeah.
I still love Katie Lotz and Sarah and her version of the Canary.
Yeah.
But the way that they are doing this, the way that they are building this character, she deserves it.
Yeah.
She's earning the character of the Black Canary.
Yeah.
And that is going to be a fun ride.
Right? Yeah.
This is going to be an interesting story and an entertaining thread to pull through this season. So, mm-hmm. And they're doing it with all of the right ingredients. They're not doing what they're doing in the movies, which is just leapfrogging ahead to these worlds and characters that they haven't earned yet. Right? In this show, they're laying the groundwork, they're building a foundation, they're doing everything that they need to do, so that when Laurel does put on that costume for the first time, when she wears a mask and goes out to fight with them, we're cheering for her,
because she's earned it, and she's totally.
We've
gone through that journey with her, which is so cool.
And you know what? The fact that they've got it right now, mirroring Thea's story,
is
really interesting. Because I was just looking up while you were talking a second ago. I was looking up possible characters that she could end up being.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, the Speedy thing is all there.
Yeah.
But I think that they might be setting her up for taking on the mantle of the Huntress. I think that might be where she's going.
Interesting.
Because I think that would be a really interesting duo to have. Is if you've got Roy and Oliver,
mm-hmm.
then to have Canary and Huntress in Laurel and Thea, I think would also be really interesting.
Couldn't me and Deirdre just be then Black Canary's sidekick? Does she have to be... Ollie's? I don't know. She could still
No,
be.
She doesn't, but that's what I'm saying is she's not gonna become Speedy.
Right.
Because he's already got Arsenal, right?
Yeah.
So she's gonna be it. If she ends up with Speedy. With an identity that already exists, it'll be something else. It won't be Speedy. It won't be Arrowette, because that's a different character.
Yeah.
Which I think I might have said.
They might just call her Speedy though still.
I don't think that they'll call her Speedy. I think it's. I think that's a little bit too.
Do you think they're going to make her a real? Oh, by the way, sorry. I don't. Before I talk over it, we're just going to talk over the scene where he's talking about his dad and how his dad died. And right. I just think
this the truth is about just, how his dad.
Truth about how his dad dies is so. I just love this scene. It's so poignant. And I think they both did such a beautiful. You job know what? With this.
It's been so long since we've talked about that that I had kind of forgotten the details of it and just take it for granted. So and the fact that. Thea doesn't know.
Yeah.
Right? So this moment, I think, really sort of grounded that character again of Oliver, as well as...
And this idea that he's got this burden that he's carrying around with him, that he has a lot of burdens, right? Yeah. These are interesting things. And that both of their parents love them so much is such an interesting thing as well, that they both sacrifice themselves for their kids, which is just a really fascinating, beautiful thing. So it makes me think that Thea is then not going to be bad, right? She's going to go through bad things.
Yeah.
But I think it's just... And I mean, I don't want them to sort of sideswipe us from the side going, actually, no, she is going to be bad because it's the triple misdirect. But
I don't think that she will be evil. I think that she will be counter to Oliver's agenda.
Right.
Okay. I think that at least for the first half of this season, if not for the whole of this season... Malcolm's going to manipulate her into a position to be against the Arrow, but not against Oliver.
Right.
And not knowing the difference until some point where that turns.
Yeah.
And then she's going to have a decision.
The beautiful undoing of Merlin's plan right now is that he didn't immediately tell her that her brother was the Arrow. Yeah. That's his undoing, is that as much as she hates lying, that's the thing that's going to turn, is the moment she finds out he's her brother... It changes absolutely everything. Yeah. So,
So, I think, that's why I think giving her the mantle of the Huntress will be... it's a logical thing, because I don't think that Thea, at least for, the near future... I'm even talking, next season.
Right.
I don't think Thea is going to be good with Oliver.
Right.
I think that there's more conflict in those characters' futures... I think that there's going to be conflict, as we've sort of seen a little bit with Oliver and Laurel. Yeah. I think that they're setting that up.
Can we take a moment to appreciate his homemade bows?
The greatest.
What?
The greatest.
What? He just made bows. It's just so amazing.
And arrows.
And arrows, yes. Oh, it's just so good.
That's because he's the Green Arrow.
Oh, it's just...
He's getting hit... That moment of where did you get these? Our hotel room is so 100% Oliver Queen that it's the best
possible
aspects of these shows.
Done. Yeah,
yeah. Just fast forwarding through some commercials again.
And the way that I don't know, it's good. He's just so handy. You forget how powerful he is and how actually good at what he does he is.
We forget that he is in season 8. Everybody else is in season 3.
Yeah.
Right? So it's I just became Arsenal. I'm going to become the Black Canary. And he's I've been this guy for quite a while.
Right, yeah.
And we are back into the episode right now. Okay. we forget that he earned his stripes a long time ago.
Yeah, yeah, with those years on the island.
Has the ability to do things like fashion bows and arrows. Actual working deadly bows and arrows.
Can I just give props to the props department though for those, because know that this was one of the funnest tasks they had last week, and also one of the worst, right? Because they get to make these bows.
Here's some furniture that you would find in a hotel room.
Good.
Make bows and arrows.
Yeah. And so they're fighting these, obviously bad guys have come, or that are not Argus. And
this is my favorite moment in the entire episode.
Yep.
When Diggle chucks him the gun, he pops up and takes out five guys.
Yeah.
And Roy looks at him like, what just happened? He's like, well, I never said I didn't know how to use a gun.
Yeah.
Chooses to use the
It's
bone
great.
Out.
And it's actually Roy's reaction after that is pretty good too.
Yeah.
Roy's reactions are so good this year. It's just sort of what it's for. And look at that. Diggle just jumped onto that truck
and pulled
the guy out, right? Very interesting. Is this Roy? Oh yeah, Roy.
And he's always doing his awesome parkour fighting style where he kind of jumps into his punches.
Yeah.
Because he is super smaller.
Awesome.
I mean, he's definitely. Yeah. Certainly more muscular than I am. But he's a bit more compact, right? Yeah. So he uses that
it's great
speed and agility where I think Oliver is a little bit more direct, right?
Yeah.
I love it when characters have their own style. And this coming from a Star Wars background, and every character in the prequels has their own lightsaber fighting style, and that's a really important part of their character.
Right.
When I see it in a show like this, it's like, yes, other people care about that stuff, right? They have signatures to the way that they do things.
Yeah, it's super cool.
And it makes it so that it's not just, we're not just watching the same choreographies over and over again.
So this is the moment where Diggle is getting this information from the guy, right?
Yeah.
That you don't know who Waller turns you into, right? The things she can make you do, which is really this thing where he's like, please just tell Waller I'm dead. I really just want out. It's just very interesting. And I think
that speaking of choreography, Diggle's choreography is the best because it is literally just punch the guy.
Punch guy.
Like, you want to talk about brute force. He's the rhino out of the three of them.
Yeah.
He just charges forward and punches a guy. Yeah. Nothing fancy about the way he does things.
She's wearing a very 90s outfit. It's very weird. Anyways,
the 90s is the retro throwback thing of the moment,
is
right?
It?
But I like her outfit. I like
it's good. I didn't say anything negative.
It's dynamic for this scene. It is very 90s, though, with that, like, I don't know what you call
top,
that. Yeah.
Whatever. It's interesting. And so she's saying she wants to leave, right, basically, and saying, I learned things and I can beat you. And then so she gets to go home, right? So basically asking if she can go, right?
Yeah, both breathing heavily. That's the closed caption on that moment.
Yeah.
I think one of the reasons why they put her in this outfit is because she looks, I think, more formidable than she has in past seasons. She's more fit.
Interesting.
Not that, I mean, she's always been in good shape, but you could see a little bit of, like, the muscle tone and stuff. Like, you could see a little bit of, like, the abs and that sort of thing, which made her look a little bit more like she's been training.
Yeah.
So I think they were sort of giving us a little subtle hint of that.
Fair.
Or they just, you know, it's a CW show.
Yeah, that's true. I feel like that's the answer.
That's probably the more obvious answer.
Anyway, so they're waiting at the airport, and she does show up, which is great. Whatever flag that was that a fake flag? Was that the Cortol Maltese flag?
I guess so.
They just made, which is very.
This is a great moment too, where this guy he gets the coffee knocked out of his hand in a second.
Yeah, right there.
And it just, I love that the steam that they added there.
Hand, yeah. And she just wipes it off like it's nothing. Sort of interesting. Ugh, I don't know. There's just little hints of things. She's got crazy freckles.
She's been forged into a blade
that
Malcolm intends to use, I think, to deal with the arrow once and for all.
You know what's so fascinating? No one's coming at the arrow directly this season. Yeah. They're using his people. If Amanda Waller and Merlin are both using two people close to Ollie to bring him down...
Yeah.
And if, oh man, that's the storm. It's that Diggle's being used by Waller, Thea's being used by Merlin, and Felicity's going to be used by Ray, all to bring Arrow Ollie down.
Yeah.
Is just so brilliant. Like, that's just so brilliant.
Okay, and we're back from commercials at Verdant. And Laurel's been waiting she clearly came here to talk to Oliver. And he wants to do something about this, about her situation.
She said snarky about Arrow not having vacation or something.
Yeah.
But
I tried to do good.
Yeah.
Which is the proper usage of that word.
I tried to do good. His freak out, though, was so good. Like, the way he just reacted and tried to, like, put his hands in his head.
He's angry.
Doesn't know how to protect. It's just very fascinating. A really great scene, I think, this whole scene.
I love it because it's, like I said, it's going to put them at odds to begin with, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I think they're setting this up perfectly for there to be two teams of superheroes in the city that are sort of like in like a kind of competition with one another.
Yeah.
Because Laurel's going to go and do this on her own. She's going to find her own Jedi master to teach her and become a superhero without Oliver's help, even though she's right now coming to him and saying, help me.
Yes.
And he's saying, no, you don't get to do this.
Yeah.
Like, think about your dad and think about, like, Sarah. His line here drives it home so perfectly that Sarah would never forgive him.
Oh, it's just
and
so,
it's like, yeah. He's absolutely right. She wouldn't. She does. She would not want this.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But Laurel doesn't care. This is what she wants. This is what she's going to do.
Yeah.
And
because as she's been talking about here, this idea that the things, this addiction that she's got, right? This idea that there's something wrong and she can't figure out how to fix it. Yeah. And that superficial. So here's where he says the line, Sarah would never forgive me.
Yeah. Which is right, so she's right, going to go find somebody else, which means that, you know, like, Oliver's not going to be okay with it. When she shows up with a mask and a costume, he's going to be pissed.
Yeah.
And so it's setting him up, it's setting them up perfectly to put Laurel and Thea together as sort of foils for which Roy and Oliver.
Oh, that's awesome.
Right.
Can we just talk about how cute this baby is?
Yes, that is an adorable
it's
baby.
It's just so cute. Doodles baby. Anyways, so
this is heartbreaking though. Every scene with the two of them,
because you just know,
just
that it's
destroys
just,
me because it can't
it
last.
Just can't last.
Those little owls. Baby. It's adorable. It's adorable.
Yeah. Anyway, so then she's talking about how she goes, right? I do whatever Amanda Waller asks. Remember? And I think Diggle. I don't know. He's
distracted.
Really, he is. Yeah.
And I think that.
That's part of the
whether or not point. I like Amanda Waller as portrayed in this series, her character is intelligent and always a few steps ahead.
Yeah.
So I think right down to the fact that
she knows,
like, the pregnancy
as a thing
might have been part of Amanda Waller's plan.
I fully feel it is. I fully feel
because
it
she
is.
Knows that that's going to put Diggle off of his game and isolate Ollie. So that she can manipulate Oliver for whatever her goals are.
Well, I think it's so that Diggle can be totally... I mean, if you break the people around Oliver, too, which is just so fascinating. And then we're back at Pretty Boy Boxer. I don't know what he is.
Ted Grant. Wildcat.
Yeah. Then back at it, some more smoker moments. Or Rolicity. I kind of like Rolicity as well. Anyways... talking about computer-y, science-y things. And her asking for time off. So this is generally just, you know, setting it up so that she's going to be on The Flash next week.
Yeah.
Which is useful. But Ray, I don't know, getting her, which I think is really interesting, or just waiting, feeling her out and knowing that there's something there. Do you think that he knows that Oliver is the Green Arrow?
I think he might have some suspicions.
Okay. I think that he thinks Felicity knows more than she is giving away.
I think that he knows that Felicity knows who
the arrow is.
Felicity is tied to the arrow. Yeah.
So these weapons that he's looking up, is this stuff that Oliver was also creating? Like, this was an evil face that he made
stuff,
at the end of this.
That stuff was the stuff that Queen Consolidated's research and development, the R&D,
the special
research and development division was working on, that they blew up, I believe, in the crossover episode, right?
That's why they
shut all that stuff down so that... Or was it that episode or... No, I guess it was the episode with the earthquake machine.
Yeah, so they just, like, wanted to keep it out of other people's hands.
In order to stop anything like that happening.
My big thing is, like, why would she fix that if that's the thing that they were trying to
keep
out of people's
hands? But that's the thing, is that she wasn't fixing it. She fixed it, but I think she was telling Ray... that she couldn't fix it. She kept saying, like, well, this is fried, I can't do anything with this. And that's why he was giving that look at the end there.
Right.
We just talked over the scene of
Nyssa.
Nyssa coming back and wanting to know where Sarah is.
Yeah.
Which is going to be a very difficult conversation to have with an arrow pointed directly at you.
Interesting episode next week. Do you think Felicity's going to be around next week, or is she going to be gone next week for Arrow?
That's a good question.
Because I feel like she's not needed right now in whatever storyline they're going to do next week.
Yeah.
So, I wish we had the next week on Arrow. How do we not have the next week on Arrow thing?
I know. It's so frustrating. It's so annoying.
So frustrating. Oh.
Anyways, so I think that they're setting it up where Ray has reason to believe that Felicity is connected to the Arrow.
Right.
He wants... I think that Ray legitimately wants in on the Arrow's business.
Yeah.
In order to help him. He goes, like, one of the reasons why this city is
turning okay around.
Is because of what you've been doing. I want to help. Right? Yeah. Because he is the Atom. He is going to be a hero in some capacity. Yeah. He's going to help these characters.
Yeah.
But as it always goes, when two superheroes meet for the first time, they gotta throw some punches.
Yeah.
Even with the crossover coming up, we know that there's gonna be a fight between.
Is there actually a fight?
Yeah, between Flash and Arrow. So, at this point, I think the trope is beyond just like a cliched trope. Like, it's just you kind of have to do it now. That's the way that it goes.
Yeah.
I don't know. We'll see. We'll see where all this stuff with the Raylicity, the smoker,
Raylicity stuff.
The smokiness of it all.
Smoky. Smoker.
But yeah, that's the.
I'm excited. It's good.
Yeah.
Ugh, I'm such a.
It was a good episode. There was a lot in this one. I mean, there were like four stories going on.
There were actually a ton.
I don't know how they do it.
When I was watching it, I was like, this is a lot. Laurel's story, I think, was the strongest in this episode out of what it's ever been. I don't think I've been that impressed with a Laurel arc
as I have in this
week's episode.
They are winning me back.
Yeah.
They're winning me back with that character. And I'm going like, okay, let's see where this goes, right? Go. And to say that, For me to say that is a lot because I want
Sarah back. Oh, it's so funny. You're so visceral reactions to that.
It kills me.
Good.
Ugh, I hope she gets another show soon. Something awesome where she can be awesome. Anyways, I think that's about it, right?
I think we sort of exhaust ourselves with these episodes recently.
Yeah.
It's true. There's just so much to talk about in the episodes. And you know what? Short and sweet. Why not?
Totally.
We sort of talked about it a long time before.
Well, thanks for listening, everybody. As always, you can get the latest Arrow and sort of DC, at least the CW DC TV news over at quiverpodcast.com, our home on the internet, where Tim keeps you guys up to date with all the latest and greatest. You can see the clips as they come out and get all the latest sort of like rumors and buzz and all that sort of thing.
Let us know what you want from Quiver, the store. My Quiver shirt just shipped today. I'm very excited. My Teespring shirt. So, if you have ideas for some Quiver merch that you're interested in, or some more ways that you can represent Quiver, let us know.
And of course, as always, you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/QuiverPodcast, where you can find the link over to our Facebook group, where awesome conversations are happening and everybody's finally starting to understand how the spoiler rule works. Mm-hmm. I always have a couple of people every week,
but
you guys
are
good.
I mean,
you guys are very self-regulating.
It's a giant group.
It is a giant group. Considering how many people.
Kudos to you guys for figuring it out. And so much thanks to our admins for just keeping that organized and on top
of
things. Dedication is amazing.
Yeah. Of course, you can also find us on Twitter at Quiver Podcast.
Cool. And I'm on Twitter personally. You can follow me at Akonkin, AKONKIN.
And I'm at Arkwulf, ARKWULF. That's it. Oh, don't forget to send in your emails to mail@quiverpodcast.com because we want to know what you guys think.
Yeah. And sometimes, if you have just general stuff about the DC-verse in general or stuff that's going on in Arrow, let us know. We know that not everybody can email in right on Wednesdays sometimes, but as soon as you watch the episodes or right before you watch an episode, if you watch some clips and you have some thoughts, that's also awesome stuff that you can send us, and we'll read it on our podcast.
Cool. Well, thank you guys for listening, and we will catch you next week for the episode that I didn't look up the title of, and I don't know what it is.
It's going to be something great.
IMDb is asking me to sign in and slowing down this process even more.
So many things are terrible. All
right, this is the worst.
We're so professional.
Vamp. The Magician.
Ooh.
The Magician.
That sounds exciting. Is that actually
the Magician?
The episode?
That's the title of the episode. Is the Magician?
All right. It's gonna be good.
Yeah. Very interesting.
And then after that, it's going to be the Felicity episode. So I'm kind of... I think after that, it's going to be the Felicity episode, at least.
Yep. The secret origin of Felicity Smoke is the episode after that. So
it's just going to be good. I'm excited for that one, so...
Cool. Yeah. Awesome. Well, thank you guys for listening, and we will catch you next week for that episode, The Magician.
Stay sharp, Arrowheads.
Let's start that off. Okay. Age of Ultron. Trailer. You saw it. I saw it. We watched it before we watched Arrow tonight. Are you excited?
It was really exciting.
I don't think that, like, the thing with the Age of Ultron thing, I guess I've talked about it a lot already today, but, like, I don't feel like there's a lot to talk about because it just looks awesome. Like, it's everything that we want, yeah. Right? Like, James Spader is going to be the best bad guy they've had yet in a Marvel movie. Like, he's going to up the ante for everybody else that comes along. And that's not to put down anybody who's done anything before. I mean, Red Skull was awesome. Mm-hmm. Tom Hiddleston's always been great as Loki, like, in all three of the movies that he's been in.
Yeah. He's only been in three movies?
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
Thor, Avengers, and Thor 2.
Yeah, crazy.
I
love him.
The villains were a little bit weak in Winter Soldier, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. The more I think about Winter Soldier, and this is an interesting thing, because a lot of people's opinion is that Winter Soldier is the best of the Marvel movies so far. But the more that I think about Winter Soldier, mm-hmm. the more that movie starts to fall apart a little bit for me. Because, like, if you really think about it, the movie's called Winter Soldier... But it has nothing to do with the Winter Soldier.
Yeah.
That character is just kind of tacked on, like, thrown in so that they, like, for an eventuality down the road, right? Like, he's not... That could have been anybody. That could have been any bad guy.
Yeah.
It didn't have to be the Winter Soldier. Yes, there were a couple of added scenes or added depth to a couple of scenes because of the fact that it's Bucky. Spoilers, I guess, but if you haven't seen Winter Soldier by now, that's your own fault. But really, like, at the end of the day, it doesn't further the actual plot that it's the Winter Soldier.
Well, I feel like they're setting it up so that they can switch the whole team around later, right? Like, that's sort of...
But that's not a good enough excuse
to
take up that much time in a movie, right? Okay. Because... Like, Winter Soldier has a pretty good pace to it, and it moves pretty quickly, but then when you stop to think about, like we never really spend any time with Bucky in Winter Soldier. Mm-hmm. He doesn't have an arc as a character in Winter Soldier. Like, it is literally just... It's as if Empire Strikes Back, for half of that movie, you followed Boba Fett around. Right?
Okay.
Like it's kind of like, well... Yeah, Boba Fett's kind of important later in the story.
Yeah, but if it was about Bucky, maybe we should spend more time.
Yeah, like if you're gonna call the movie Winter Soldier,
it should be
about Winter Soldier.
Yeah.
But
maybe they just didn't trust the property enough. Like, they really were like, people would trust Captain America. Let's go with him.
No, I think that they just have a much larger agenda than the individual movies.
Yeah.
So I think what you're seeing with like these individual stories, people are going to have a very different opinion of Iron Man 3 after they've seen Avengers 2, I think. Because there's a lot of people who are also very upset about Iron Man 3 because it wasn't what they were expecting.
I loved Iron Man 3.
I personally think that Iron Man 3 is the pinnacle. I think that it's
so
the best one that they've done. And that's saying a lot, because I really like Guardians of the Galaxy. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But Iron Man 3, it just, like, the heart of it is so important. And, yeah, like, what happens to Tony Stark as a character is so important.
Yeah.
And I, along with other people who like the movie, I think, see where they're going, yeah, right? Like, that you see that there's... Not only is Iron Man 3 itself a payoff, because it's sort of the culmination of everything that happens through the other three movies that he's in, but it's also building up to what's coming, yeah, in now Avengers 2, and then eventually Cap 3 and Avengers, yeah, 3 and all this stuff, where they're very clearly setting up Tony Stark to take the fall, right? Like, he's the guy that everything that goes wrong in this movie is going to get pinned on.
Because, yeah, he's the most human and relatable, yeah, and it's our window.
He's
in,
also,
right,
the foundation, right? Yeah. So how do you, yeah, how do you shake things up in the Marvel Universe the most,
yeah,
by just taking out the foundation, yeah, just destroying it,
yeah,
so that the whole universe gets leveled, mm-hmm, and then you get to build it all back up, yeah, again with a new set of Avengers or with a different status quo, right?
Feel
this is what
team,
comics,
yeah,
do. Like, yeah, when you talk about comic books and editorial changes that happen, the term that gets brought up the most is status quo. Because throughout, like, from the 40s, the 30s and 40s, mm-hmm, when Superman showed up,
mm-hmm,
and then really starting in the 50s when they started to establish all these other characters and they started to share the universe, and then straight through to the 80s, everything was status quo.
Right.
There weren't really earth-shattering things. Like, every month, you picked up your Superman book, and it was Superman on another adventure, self-contained within that issue.
Right.
And then DC started doing these crisis things. Like, mm-hmm, they rebooted it with rebooted Superman with John Byrne, and then did all the Infinite Crisis stuff, or whatever order that's in. And they started shaking up the status quo, right? And DC does it with these hard resets every once in a while, and I feel like that's less interesting than what Marvel does.
Super less interesting. Can we just, I mean, I want to talk about this, though, because whenever I see a Marvel trailer or a Marvel movie, my insides get, like, I'm excited, and my stomach
visceral,
just goes,
right?
It's visceral. It's like, this is what good, great storytelling should do.
Yeah.
And I get so excited.
Yeah.
But DC is actually my favorite property in terms of, like, the people that they own.
Right?
And so it's really hard, especially something that we didn't talk about last week was the DC movie announcement. And it's just left this terrible taste in my mouth. And I don't know what to do about it.
You know, it's just to finish what I was saying.
Yeah.
Marvel knows how to do the status quo shakeup while maintaining their continuity in their universe.
Yeah, yeah.
They, in Spider-Man over the last year, they had Spider-Man and Dr. Octopus switch bodies.
Yeah, I
remember
you saying that.
Spider-Man
that just sounds
died.
So cool. Yeah, yeah.
And now Spider-Man's back, and it's Peter Parker again, and I just this last week read Amazing Spider-Man Volume 1, which is like the sort of, it's not a reboot, it's just a relaunch, like it's a soft reboot of the character, because now he's back and everything's back to normal. I'm using my quote fingers, but nothing is back to normal. Everything's totally different for Peter now, but the character's back.
Right.
So, like, there's this great touchstone of Peter Parker making jokes, being fun.
Yeah.
The first volume's called The Parker Luck, which, like, he's Spider-Man's the unluckiest character in comics, right? Like, everything bad always happens to him. But they play it up in, like, in a happy-go-lucky way in this. And I was not reading Spider-Man comics before. And they've done this with Spidey a few times in the last 5 or 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
And every time, it's always felt a little bit lame and forced. But with this last one, I am so glad to have... Like, I loved Superior Spider-Man. I loved Dr. Octopus as Spidey. But I'm so happy to have Peter Parker back.
Right.
Because everything that's happened has consequences. And it's this great world that he's coming back to, that he's crafted, that Dr. Octopus sort of built up around him. And now he has to figure everything out. and it's all, like, the status quo is just totally different,
right?
Right? But DC, they nuke everything,
yeah.
Right? Like, the New 52 just says, oh, have you been enjoying what we've been doing with certain characters? Well, too bad. We're going to slap you in the face and start over from scratch. Except for Batman. Batman gets to stay the way that he was. Like, Batman gets to continue the story that we were in the middle of telling, because Batman fans are better than other fans for some reason. I don't understand why. But, like, they get what they want. They get to keep
that character.
It's
so annoying. You know what kind of bothers me? And I feel like this is, like, the thing, is that they just, like, Batman is the thing that they have to do, and then everything around it they sort of just mess up or don't care about.
Yeah.
And it really bothers me. I'm like, these are the things that are, like, should be your staples and your...
And, you know, my thing is that Batman is honestly the least interesting character in the DC universe.
He's just so boring. I don't like him.
There are good Batman stories, and there are bad Batman stories, and...
Just like everything, but yeah.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, it just feels like you're banging the same drum over and over and over again. And this whole... All this stuff with the movies, it just feels so hollow and disingenuous.
Yeah, and that's the part that really bothers me, is that you can't... Yeah. The reason it worked for Marvel is because they just sort of... It ground up and it grew, and it was someone that cares about this property.
Well, you have one guy. You have one guy in Kevin Feige who sits there and goes, what's next? What are we doing?
Yeah.
How are we doing this?
And understands that you have to give, like, how to delegate appropriately. Because I was listening, and I think I mentioned this before, but the idea that the female writer of Guardians of the Galaxy, she said she sat down and Kevin had a meeting with five writers and said, okay, don't take an A property, don't take a B property, but we're going to let you into the vault. Here's all the C properties.
Yeah.
Pick whatever you want and make something with it.
Yeah.
And that's where Guardians of the Galaxy came from, because he knew what he needed to protect, and then this ability where if you make someone care about something a lot and then find a way to incorporate that into a larger world, it's how you honor those things, and it's why they work.
Yeah.
Instead of just going, we have all these big things, it doesn't really matter what we do with it, we'll sell out anyways. So
that's DC's thing.
Like,
DC's thing is like, well, you know what, if this Wonder Woman thing doesn't go, at least we've given ourselves, like, if people don't like Gal Gadot in the role, we've given ourselves a buffer zone to recast and do it differently. And it's like, and you can see it. You can pull apart that slate that they've created, and you can see where the business decisions were made.
Yeah.
And I think with Marvel, you can, if you really look and read between the lines, you can see a lot of business decisions get made for sure. Because it is a business.
Yeah.
Entertainment is all about profit, right? But you also see exactly what you said, which is creators and creatives being given ownership and that ownership really shining through. So when you give James Gunn Guardians of the Galaxy to put his signature on, but then you got to go like, well, but like, it's got to match the rest of the universe. That's the only thing that you have to do, right? Like you can come in the sandbox and you can play, but don't bring other toys into the sandbox without talking about it. That's why Edgar Wright got parted ways with Marvel over Ant-Man, because I think that Edgar Wright came in and he started making a Scott Pilgrim Hot Fuzz Marvel movie, and Kevin Feige went, well, we can't have word balloons popping out. That's inconsistent with the rest of the universe.
Yeah.
And Edgar Wright went, well, that's my vision. That's what you brought me in for. And he went, no, I brought you in to make a Marvel movie.
Yeah.
If you were going to go make a Star Wars movie, you're not going to put word bubbles in that, are you?
Yeah.
It's a Star Wars movie, right? It's got to look and feel like the rest of the Star Wars universe. That's what you have to do. And the Marvel Cinematic Universe is so solid that I think that you can say the same thing, where it's like, well, we have set rules.
Yeah, but you,
and
you
as
that,
long
yeah.
as you can stick within those rules, keep the aesthetic similar, keep the interlocking pieces the same, then do whatever you want with the rest of it. Like talking raccoon the heck out of it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because we've laid the groundwork for you to be able to do that.
Yeah.
And you doing that means that we get to do crazy stuff later. Yeah. But you can't break the fourth wall, because if you break the fourth wall, then
you've changed the whole world.
Then we're in a different dynamic, and that's not the way that this works, right? I personally think that Edgar Wright leaving Ant-Man is the best thing that can happen for that movie, because I think that it would have felt really disjointed with him.
Right.
Because he just... Edgar Wright, I love him. I love most of his movies. I think that The World's End was a little bit blah. It was a little kind of... It had its own unique stuff, but it felt like the third time out making that movie, because it was. But Scott Pilgrim's one of my favorite movies. Like it's especially from like a stylistic aesthetic point of view. There's nothing else like it. It is unique and has its own identity in, you know, this day and age. It's very hard to do. But that's not what I want in a Marvel movie. Yeah. I want Marvel movies that I want all of the stories to look like they belong together, right? And Marvel's got that figured out, because Kevin Feige has it figured out. Mm-hmm. There's nobody like that
at DC.
At DC.
Yeah.
And the bigger problem is that you've got... Dan DiDio is a terrible person to be in charge of DC, because he doesn't care about diversity. He doesn't care about representation. These things aren't important to him. That's not what he's looking at, right? Mm-hmm. I think Joe Quesada over at Marvel is looking at that, because he's looking and going, what's the best business decision for us to make? Yeah. And I think that it's coming out of that, but I think that it's also coming out of them trusting their creatives, right?
Yeah.
But I do think that they look at it and they go, like, you know what would be really great right now? Is if we put a teenage Muslim girl in a superhero book. Because
apparently it's doing really well.
Apparently it's fantastic. It. Yeah. And her character is catching on with all sorts of writers. Yeah. She's popping up all over the place.
Yeah.
This is
Ms. Marvel, right?
Yeah, Ms. Marvel. Yeah. And she's an asset to that universe now, right? But if you're not going to take those risks, you don't get to benefit from that sort of thing. But Marvel has always been a little bit more on that edge than DC, because DC has this legacy that they play into.
Well, that's the thing that I think is the problem with DC, is that they feel like they have this legacy to protect or something, and I think it just becomes a hindrance more than a help.
Yeah, I mean, there are good things being done, but I feel like rather than getting out in front of it and making some cool, unique decisions like they do at Marvel, I think that DC is reacting, right? So when people got mad and said, you know, there aren't enough characters of color in the New 52, like, you relaunch the universe, you rewrite your entire history, you have the opportunity to do some crazy stuff, and what do? You have a lineup of Justice League characters, which is like six white people and a black guy.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, what about the Green Lantern? What about Hal Jordan dictates that he has to be a white guy? Nothing. Yeah. Yeah. What about Bruce Wayne dictates that he has to be a white guy? Maybe a little bit, right? Because he's got to be affluent and blah, blah, blah. And historically speaking, it would be a little bit more difficult to throw a minority in there. But... like, what about so many of these characters dictates that they need to look one way or the other? Mm-hmm. Nothing, right? But they were reluctant to do anything. They were reluctant to put more than one girl on the team, which is ridiculous, right? Yeah. That's insane today to do that.
Yeah.
But now what you're seeing is Iris West on The Flash is black, and that's... Mm-hmm. On the Flash TV series.
I think
that's filtering into the comics and changing things.
So here's what I think. I think Marvel has movies figured out.
Yeah.
And their TV properties are not as strong because they have to compete or sort of try to fit
into... Well, they've only got one TV property so far.
I'm looking forward to Agent Carter. It seems like it'll be interesting. But what I know it's not feasible, but like DC, at least what I hope they do is understand what strong television series they have.
Yeah.
And try to honor those and don't mess with them, right? Like, let them be what they are and nurture those and make them and allow them to maybe integrate into the comic books and to sort of have that world created around it. And I think that that's one thing that DC did do pretty well. And I think adding with Smallville, recognizing how important Smallville was and doing things. So I really hope that DC, I mean, I forgive their movie stuff. I'll watch it because I freaking love DC and I'll just watch it and I like those characters and that's a terrible reason to go watch it, but I will. But I won't love it in the same way that I love the Marvel movies and I'll sort of do it begrudgingly and I just want to hold on to the DC universe.
Marvel's built a relationship with its audience, right? And DC, I mean, really, what we're talking about right now, it's a little bit unfair because DC at the moment with this upcoming slate really only has one movie under its belt, and that's Man of Steel.
Yeah.
And that's a very polarizing movie.
Yeah.
Even with us, it's constantly fighting a battle within me because I think that the plot of that movie is a little bit weak. But I think that the casting in that movie is exceptional.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think that that is one of the best casts that has ever been put together for a superhero film or a comic book movie or even just like your standard sci-fi fantasy movie. Like, it is one of the best genre casts that's ever been put together. I mean, you get Henry Cavill, you get Amy Adams, and you get Lawrence Fishburne, and just so many actors, and Michael Shannon. Like, you put these people together on screen, and it's like electric, right? But then you mire it in this needlessly gritty, darker in tone than it should be movie. And I just, there are parts of it that rub me the wrong way. And so going into everything else they do, starting to see footage from Batman versus Superman, Batman v Superman, Dawn of Justice, which could not be more of a think tank.
They are still brainstorming names for these Justice League movies, right? They're not genuinely going to call it Justice League Part 1 and Justice League Part 2.
The problem there is that they don't know what they're going to call Justice League because it's still a few years out. Right. And we have to go to the focus group a few years from now and figure out if Rise, Dawn, Fall, Avenging-ness, whatever the stupid adjective, adverb...
Yeah.
Of the day is that it'll be tagged on to Justice League. So it'll be, because whatever the new Planet of the Apes movie is called, if it's Conquest of the Planet of the Apes, then it'll be Justice League Conquest of Earth or something, right? Like, they'll pull it into whatever stupid, because it's not DC making those decisions, it's Warner Brothers making those decisions. And Warner Brothers doesn't have the legacy with those characters. Right. DC does. So they're just looking at it and going, what are the things that we're going to throw into the blender here that are going to put the most dollars on the wall, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's what they're looking at.
And you know what's so frustrating to me, though, is that they are going to make the dollars. And I just wish that wasn't true.
Yeah.
Like, I wish that, like, I just think that they can take things for granted in a way that I wish they wouldn't. Right, with their storytelling, and that they would maybe just dig a little deeper.
Okay. There's one other thing that I want to talk to you about that I want to tag on to the end of the episode. Because I watched Ghostbusters on Saturday night with some friends. You couldn't make it, but you were invited.
Yes, I was. Thank you. Sorry.
And last week, huge news came out that they're moving forward with a Ghostbusters reboot with an all-female cast.
Yes.
And it's Paul Feig, who directed Bridesmaids and The Heat and a bunch of other stuff. So the conversation has been a lot about, like, well, they're going to reboot Ghostbusters with an all-female cast. And I want to know, before I give my opinion on it, I want to know how you feel about it. Because I'm sure you've seen Ghostbusters.
Possibly once a really long time ago.
Oh, okay.
I'm familiar with those.
Okay, so not having really
I have no emotions to it.
Okay.
So, first of all, you put the name Paul, what's his face, on it.
Yeah.
I don't know what the purpose of it being all female is, aside from it being like a marketing gimmicky thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, if it's created, if it's like for female audiences or created using female creators, and they thought that this voice would be really interesting to change the narrative.
Yeah.
That's a different conversation. But if it's like, Bridesmaids did really well and it sold to guy audiences, yeah, why don't we take this guy thing and put girls in it and just have the same director that knows how to direct these girls to make them be laughed at? Like that, I don't know. I don't know. I'm sure I have lots of opinions.
So it rubs you the wrong way.
It's just sort of... it seems gimmicky more than an actual genuine reason, yeah, to tell a story,
yeah,
which, again, I don't know. I don't know who was the person that decided that it should be all female. I feel like having... Why don't you have three women and one man? Or what? I don't know how many Ghostbusters are. Three? Five,
there's four.
Four.
There's
right? Four. Have three women and one man.
Yeah.
What's wrong with that? You can have men on screen, right? It's, yeah, not like it needs to be all girls. It's, yeah, just the idea of trying to tell, like, a multi-person story.
So... to springboard off what you're saying, because I'm glad that that's how you feel about it, because then it makes me feel a little bit better about how I feel about it. I have a lot of emotions tied up in Ghostbusters,
okay,
but I do have the ability to pick up those emotions and set them aside.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that they should be making any new Ghostbusters movies. I think that they made two Ghostbusters movies and a couple hundred episodes of the TV series. And there's been some really great comic books recently, and a really cool video game that was a sequel to those movies.
Mm-hmm.
And to be perfectly honest, I'm good. Like, that's all I need. Watching Ghostbusters on Saturday reaffirmed my feelings that there is no need to go back and remake that movie,
mm-hmm,
because that movie is 100% A+, perfect.
Yeah.
Right? Like, nothing needs to change in, right, Ghostbusters. You're going to find plot holes in anything, so you can pick it apart and find at least a plot hole,
yeah,
in Ghostbusters. But the performances are all solid. The writing's all solid. The directing is solid. The special effects are, mm-hmm, great for the time. Use maybe a little bit of touch-up. Watching it in,
yeah,
high def on,
yeah,
Blu-ray,
yeah, yeah,
pointed out some of the dated, mm-hmm, special effects. But, like, as it is... for the time that it was created, I'll put it on a list with a few other great movies, and because it's me making a list, they're mostly going to be genre, but Star Wars, right? Star Wars, Empire Strikes Back, Return of the Jedi, Planet of the Apes, the original, like the very first movie, right? 2001, like there are movies that they don't need to be revisited. You don't need to go back and remake them. That aside, there's money to be made off of the Ghostbusters franchise,
mm-hmm,
so somebody's going to try and make it, because that's the era that we live in today. A hard reboot is a fine thing. Go ahead, because Harold Ramis just died, so he can't be in it. Bill Murray has expressed on several occasions that he doesn't want to have anything to do with it, except for maybe, like, if they kill him in the first reel and then he gets to be
a ghost
and have just be a voice for the,
yeah,
rest of the movie,
cool, yeah,
he's cool with that. Because he really enjoyed going back and doing the video game, because,
cool,
they all did their voices in that. So who have you got left? You've got Dan Aykroyd and Ernie Hudson, because maybe Annie Potts will come back. She was Janine. But Rick Moranis doesn't make movies anymore. So...
He
doesn't make movies anymore. Like, he's kind of done with that. He produces country music,
right?
Just hangs out on a ranch in,
awesome,
in Canada somewhere.
Why not?
And that's just what he does.
Good
and that's cool.
Him.
That's what he wants
that's
to
cool.
do. Like, he's got a
yep.
he's got an awesome portfolio of fantastic films.
Yeah.
He has enough to hang his hats on, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I get that. But basically, Dan Aykroyd is the only one who is championing it.
Mm-hmm.
That, to me, says, don't hard reboot it, soft reboot it. The Ghostbusters happened.
Yeah, why don't you just have, like, Dan Aykroyd mentoring
set it in
new
Seattle,
team?
Set it in San Francisco, set
yeah.
it in a different city with a lot of great history that
yeah.
you can pull from, that's not New York, that's not the East Coast,
yeah.
right? Set it in Canada.
Yeah.
Set it somewhere else that's
reboot.
Not North
yeah,
America.
Yeah, I didn't realize it was going to be a hard
but
reboot. Yeah, that's weird.
Come up with a plot,
mm-hmm.
create some cool characters,
yeah.
and then cast for those characters. Don't go into a situation saying, we're going to have an all-female cast, we'll figure out the story later.
Well, obviously,
like, that bothers
I feel like
me.
They surely didn't do that.
They don't have a
that
script.
Would be,
they don't
really,
have a script.
They just sort of...
They have no story.
Yeah.
They have producers and they have a director, and that's all they have right now.
Do they know?
And more
they
than likely,
cast?
Because it's Paul Feig, more than likely Melissa McCarthy is going to be in it. Now, again, I want to state for the record: put as many girls in this as you want, put as many women in it as you want. I do not care. Mm-hmm. That doesn't bother me, as long as the characters make sense and there's a story and as long as them being female is not just like you said, like a stunt, like a marketing ploy.
So,
but like as long as it's a part of, not even a part of the story, but if it's irrelevant, it's irrelevant. They're just all women. That's fine. But
or if there's
a reason
that necessitates that they're all women, like they decided to fight. So can I just?
Well,
say,
I don't want Melissa McCarthy in a Ghostbusters movie. I don't want it. I don't like Melissa McCarthy. I think that she's got one funny thing that she does, which is everything that she did in Bridesmaids, and then they just keep putting her in the same situations over and over with slightly different characters.
So something that really bothers me about that is that one of the things about Ghostbusters that makes it charming and what it is because it's sort of four ugly dudes, right? Like, that's the thing with the Beatles, too. It's like four ugly dudes.
To be fair, it's three ugly dudes and Ernie Hudson, because I think Ernie Hudson's a handsome guy.
But so this is the thing that really bothers me in Hollywood.
Yeah.
You can't just put, a bigger actress in something and be like, look at all this diversity and these different
representation.
People we have represented.
Yeah.
But so if it's about, awkward women being cool and fighting ghosts, that's cool.
Yeah.
I think the only thing that really did this, and it really bothers me, but House Bunny did a really good job of having actual, women in it. And I mean, obviously then you look at the freaking cover of it and it's just Anna Faris, which is pretty, so people will pick it up because it's pretty.
And the halfway through the movie, the only message you've got so far is change yourself and everybody will love you.
But they fixed that near the end, which is good.
It writes itself.
The thing is that, I mean, they had the one pretty girl that they then banked on selling the movie for.
Yeah.
But with Ghostbusters, if they do that, it's disingenuous to what Ghostbusters is.
Yeah.
And that really bothers me. So if you're putting women in to sell it to men, then that's not okay.
Yeah.
But if you feel like there's genuinely a story to be told about women fighting ghosts that are kind of awkward, that's an awesome story. I would totally watch that. But again, anything else from that is you can't just grab a demographic say, let's do this.
I feel like you just write your story. I think you write your characters with non-gender specific motives. Right, you just go at it, not necessarily, because I mean, having
you can't,
a couple of
the thing is, gender you can't
specific
really
characters.
Do that.
But just write characters, right? Just write some characters, and then just audition people, and don't write down on your sheet for auditioning people that we're only looking at white guys with blonde hair that are over 6 foot.
I would really it if they started to build something and then cast it and let those people put their own paw prints on it or something like that. I don't know. It's super hard when you have... It's one of those things. It's why Community started to work halfway through the first season.
Yeah.
Because instead of
they
them, then they let those
characters,
be written by the actors. Which I think worked really well because it didn't. I mean, you go back and you're like, how on earth was Danny Glover trying to play a jock? It's really weird.
Donald Glover,
whatever.
Community would have been very different if
Danny Glover
would have been in.
Anyways, Donald Glover.
Yeah.
Anyways,
yeah.
I'm sure.
Yeah. When you go back and you watch the first season, especially those first 6 episodes, it shows that they just kind of cast these actors and then found out we've struck gold with every single one of them.
Yeah.
Let's start writing for their strengths,
right?
Yeah,
exactly.
So, I agree. I think if, filmmaking 101, if you don't have a strong script to begin with, you're going to make a terrible movie.
Right.
So, right out the gate, I feel like they have shot themselves in the foot because they've made all of these statements.
Well, I don't understand how you can hire a director before you have the script.
Because he's
one
of the ones writing it. Because he's one of those directors that writes the screenplay as well, right?
Interesting.
And there's nothing wrong with that, but if you walk out and you make a bunch of flashy statements, which I think is what they've done, I think in order to distance it from, I think that's the main motivating factor. Is that they can do two things here. They can say, we've got Paul Feig, the guy who brought you Bridesmaids. So we're basically going to make Bridesmaids with ghosts and proton
pads.
Right? Yeah, well, that would be a terrible movie. But That's basically, like, because that's them, something that Variety can pick up and send across the wire, and every news outlet's gonna just start barking about it, right? But the other thing, I lost track and like lost my train of thought. But the other thing that you do is Ghostbusters is Ghostbusters, and it's a freaking institution, and 20-somethings and 30-somethings have so many emotions and preconceived notions tied into it that you have to distance yourself. Yeah. It's the same problem that Marvel's going to have in another 5 years when they have to replace Robert Downey Jr. and put a different Iron Man in the suit. They are going to have to go a different direction, right? They're going to have to either like remove him from the films for a while and then reintroduce a different actor. Yeah. Or they're going to have to go with somebody that is so different from Robert Downey Jr. that you don't even think about it. Which they did that with Ed Norton to Mark Ruffalo, I think, right?
Yeah, like, they just sort of did something.
You went from sort of like nevish scientist Bruce Banner to kind of rugged... Like,
I love him so much. Handsome.
But at the same time, vulnerable scientist, right? Yeah. So, like, they went in a totally different direction. And so when you're watching Avengers, you don't even think about Ed Norton. Yeah. You just look at it and go, man, Mark Ruffalo is really great, right? Yeah. Like, he's such a great actor.
Yeah.
And I bet he didn't complain at all on set.
Yeah.
Which Ed Norton... is notorious for. But yeah, I don't know. I think it's interesting, and I think we'll probably talk about it as more stuff comes out.
Yeah.
But I wanted your opinion on it because I know that these are things that you concern yourself with.
Yeah, yeah, no,
so
I'm interested.
I wanted to make sure that where I was coming from wouldn't be, that I wouldn't be, you know, roasted on a spit for it.
No, it's not. It's just like really, with no information, it's hard to talk about stuff.
Yeah.
But I think one of the coolest things that they could do is if Dan Aykroyd was around, like if he had like a niece or a daughter or something that then took up a ghost busting mantle, that'd be kind of cool, right? Yeah. And then you'd follow that through. And just,
what I want, I don't want a movie. I want a TV series. I think that like a 13 episode Netflix series or HBO series or something like that, with a nice budget, because I think you could do that stuff on TV.
Mm-hmm.
I think that would be much more interesting to me than going back and trying to recapture the magic of the movie specifically.
Yeah, you just can't do that. Because
you're not going to
do it. But the thing is camp doesn't work anymore.
Yeah.
It's either going to be crappy camp that doesn't work properly, or it's going to be a horror film. And neither of those are Ghostbusters.
Yeah.
So you have to find this middle ground that doesn't exist anymore. It's not the 80s, right? So it's just really... it's going to be difficult.
Well, we just talked about Scott Pilgrim. It kind of hit some of that stuff. But it's very silly, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's a cartoon.
Yeah.
Live-action cartoon. But, yeah, I don't know how they're going to pull it off. I don't know how they're going to do it while, you know, having to stick to all of these wild declarations that are being made about it.
Yeah.
It's just so much more important to me that somebody writes a good story.
Yeah.
Then, like, is there a reason to tell another Ghostbusters story?
Yeah.
Right?
Well, that's
because
always the thing, right?
In the 90s, when Ghostbusters 2 came out, what we discovered is, no, there's not a reason to tell another Ghostbusters story, other than we want to see these characters on screen.
Yeah.
Right? And if you're going to remove the characters from the equation, then all you're selling me is a poster with the No Ghost logo on it.
Yeah.
That's all you're selling me, right?
Yeah.
Like, and maybe some proton packs, and like, I don't know. Like, there are possibilities, but at the same time, I just don't know if it's gonna be handled well.
Right.
I don't know if it's the right people. I don't know if it's the right attitude to take with it. It feels a little bit disingenuous to me. I think Paul Feig is an okay director, but he's no Ivan Reitman in his heyday, right? Like it's not, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think there are better people to give that to. I think that there are other directors that could handle it better. But we'll have to wait and see.
Yes.
Avengers 2 looks good. DC looks scary. And Ghostbusters is on uncertain ground. So I think that's what we've come to the conclusion of.
Cool.
Okay, now let's actually talk about Arrow, which is why we're here.